Grade 4 Conference, Lecture 34, Norse Mythology, Part 12. I've spoken of the importance of the transition from temperament to personality that begins to occur in the midst of Grade 4. I can't stress enough how often this is overlooked. Even when I am asked to do teacher evaluations in the 7th or 8th grade, I'm often asked, is the teacher paying attention to the children's temperaments? And my answer is, I certainly hope not, because by 7th and 8th grade, those temperaments are secondary or even tertiary aspects of the child's being. And 4th grade is where this happens. So, when we talk about the Aesir, particularly the ones who are going to have the most adventures, it's good to have a look at how this is actually going on there, how these are beings who are the first beings, we might say, at least among the northern peoples, who are bringing the astral body to bear upon the etheric and starting to transform it. So we have first Odin, the father of all of the gods, the one most connected to the basis of the world, the one who worked with his brothers to overcome the sheer physicality of Ymir and transform him into a habitable place. So it's not surprising that he would carry as his baseline the melancholic temperament. And we will see again and again how Odin is vouchsafed the picture of the eventual destruction of the gods, the coming of Ragnarok, how much of his work and activity is trying to forestall the inevitability of the activity of Skuld, the end of things. And, of course, the melancholic temperament, as you all probably know, it bears tremendous forces of memory. The memory gets imprinted right into the bones. And indeed, it is this bone-like spear that Odin carries around, which is where gods and Jotuns and others make their pledges, make their contracts, speak the words that will be fulfilled, that must be truly fulfilled, and when they don't, then problems are going to occur. So he carries the memory of all of the bonds of faith, all of the will that has been pledged over time. And he is, we could say, he must become an increasingly introverted personality, that he carries more and more within, even as he's trying in an external way to bring healing and to bring sustainability to the gods. Next, phlegmatic. This is a trickier one to find among these active Norse gods, but I'd say it is very clearly to be found in the being of Baldur. The god who carries goodness and a placid quality, whom everyone loves, who is able to bring peace and a sense of serenity and stability to all of the gods, and who, like many a phlegmatic child, never gets ill, has tremendous etheric forces of healing, which he's able to radiate around him, and this allows him to be virtually indestructible. Only we will discover a trick, a stratagem, does eventually result in Baldur's tragic death. So there we have phlegmatic, but it's a phlegmatic who becomes ever more extroverted, whose phlegmatic etheric forces are able to spread among the gods and bring peace and life and light where otherwise it would not be. Astral, not at all hard to find. All of the gods, of course, are imbued with lively, mobile astral forces, but the one who embodies the astral body most clearly and most tragically in the story is Loki, who is not really an Aesir, is not really a Jotun, is certainly not a human being. He comes from somewhere else, and we are a little unclear. His origins are a little bit clouded, like many other things in the Norse myths. But in his case, where the gods all have a clear provenance, his is not at all. Here we see the astrality of the sanguine temperament at work. Charming, clever, resourceful, never stuck for very long in one place or another. Indeed, not even his form is ever stuck. He's a changeling, and he's particularly good at changing into animal forms because he is so astral, and even changing his gender because there again, the astral body is built up of polarities, and these polarities are often easily able to flow into one another. So he embodies all that is good and wonderful about the astral body, and he is the one who brings, along with another god, the forces of laughter into the classroom. And we'll see how much comedy, how much laughter, how much absurdity there is in these wonderful Norse myths. Compare them to the stories of the Hebrew scriptures, in which only Sarah laughs once when she is told that at age 90 she will bear a child, and then she names her child Laughter, because that laughter is so significant and so unique and so unexpected in those stories. Here, wherever Loki is present, for the most part, at least certainly in the central part of our blocks where we're telling the adventures of the gods, there's going to be something very funny happening, funny at work. But we also see how the catabolic forces of the astral body in the end must be attended to, and how sanguines can carry within them, unknowingly at times, but sometimes maliciously as well, very destructive forces, that they really have to learn how to control this. And Loki is, of course, increasingly introverted because he's exiled eventually. He's removed from the world of the gods, and he begins to work then in a very nefarious way, a pernicious way, where he is unseen, but his children, that which he has created in the world, come into being very strongly. We'll hear more about that. And for the choleric, not hard to find at all. Thor is perhaps the most perfect representation of the powerful, ego-bearing forces of the choleric temperament. But an ego which is almost completely outside of the one who is choleric, and therefore is always acting from outside. So Thor's actions are almost always reactions, and he's like a tripwire. The slightest thing happens, and that great hammer of his Mjolnir is sent off to smash somebody's head or other, and then like lightning, come back to its origin. Thunder and lightning, these very powerful choleric forces, live very strongly in Thor. But as Steiner tells us about the choleric, cholerics, though they are filled with leadership capacities, they do not want to lead. They want someone stronger than they to lead them. They want to be number two, not number one. And Thor looks to Odin for guidance, and sometimes wisely, sometimes rashly, he also follows Loki. Loki, with his charming sanguinity, is able to lead Thor on many a wild chase, and sometimes helpfully, sometimes not. You'll see this dynamic in your classroom as well, how powerfully in these middle school years the sanguine children become class leaders, not necessarily permanently, but at this time the sanguine temperament becomes very strong. When it's time to cast the class play, if it is indeed a Norse play, you'll see how many children want to be Loki, whether their temperament is true to that or not, and you'll see how many of the children, not necessarily wanting the part of Loki themselves, will invariably point to just the right person who should be playing it, which will probably be one of the class's strong sanguines. So here Thor needs guidance, and he becomes more and more extroverted. That's his personality change, more of an extroverted choleric as the stories go on, as he must fight more and more of the external battles, trying to hold off the inevitable destruction of the Norse gods. I want to say a little bit about how these stories can be told. If you think back, grades 1, grades 2, to a great degree, grade 3 as well, you have probably been speaking in a fairly undramatic way to the children when you relate stories. Maybe you've deepened your voice to sound more like Yahweh speaking forcefully to the Hebrews. Maybe you've lightened your voice here and there if it was a woman or a child speaking. But basically, you recognize that you do not want to impose drama on the children. You know, if you go to these professional storyteller festivals and conferences and see world-renowned popular storytellers who are usually incredibly good, but it's so different from the way in which the non-dramatic way in which we work with children up to the age of 9 or 10. But now, with the settling in of the astral body in grade 4, something very different is called for. And now it is right to bring a great deal of drama. Change your voice, move around the room more. I would say most of these stories are not so well presented by people sitting on a stool, which seems to be more and more the rule, I guess, so that the music stand with the notes isn't disturbed. You've got to let that go and really be moving, so that the children's astral bodies are given something that they can emulate, that they can follow. If you're not dramatic in your telling of these stories, all of the drama will occur among the children. And you may not always want that. It's going to make for a very noisy and often rambunctious class. So one way to keep the children more serene is that you bring the drama and you show how you can shift from the higher, mischievous voice of Loki to the deeper tones of Thor, to the more reasoned cadences of Odin, to the gentler sound of Baldur and all of the other gods and goddesses in between. Very important. Another aspect of this is that a change that began in grade 3 now becomes more heightened in grade 4 and will continue to be, and that is that you are telling different kinds of stories, that you're making different kinds of presentations to the children. In grades 1 and 2, everything was story. It was purely narrative. In grade 3, you had the tales of the Hebrew Scriptures, narrative, and then you had house building, you had gardening and farming, you had fabrics, fibers. There you were a little bit more expository when you spoke, though probably you still framed everything in a story. In grade 4, now you're going into zoology, the first natural science. Now you're talking about geography, which we could say is the first social science that the children are hearing. Now you have subjects, which will grow in number in the years to come, which are much more expository in nature, in which you are presenting increasing factual material, more information, and you are, in a way, speaking with a greater degree of objectivity. Not everything will be framed by a story. In fact, some things would suffer if they were told as purely as stories, which is an error made by many teachers in zoology. We'll be talking about that later. So that means, because you are speaking in a still less dramatic way in a number of subjects, the Norse myths give you license to bring more drama there. Now you want the children to have a clear differentiation about that which is dramatic and narrative, more imaginative, and that which is more earthly in nature, more factual, more delineated by their sensory experience. So this is a very big step for a teacher to take. I will give you a model of this soon. It's only a model. It's not meant to be your way of doing it. And because I'm not doing it as a video, you're only hearing me and not seeing me jump around. But anyway, just to give you an idea, and I will do this for zoology as well, give you an example of a way to present something to the children. But the Norse myths this year represent your dramatic debut. Milk it for all it's worth. We'll go on.